Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 21, delivered on November 7, 2017. The title of this lecture is Systematic and Unsystematic Risk.
Today, Systematic and Unsystematic Risk. I've done this before, and as I had told you at the very beginning of the course, I bring up a topic over and over again and finally consolidate it later in the course. This is a good example of that. The title is Systematic and Unsystematic Risk. Now, one thing I will point out is in the textbook, they give you some formulas that can be really tedious in practice. And I strongly encourage you to try to use Excel rather than trying to put in, especially if it's a large number of returns you're trying to calculate for something like covariance or standard deviation. And I will attempt to show you one here, but I'm having such a problem with the scripting errors that you've seen happen before on this. But I'll give it the old college try here and hope that this time really give it a try here. And I'm showing you this in Excel as much as anything else to give you a kind of a heads up on some of the skill sets that are some of the skills and tools that are useful in Excel for the remainder of your work here and if you run into it in your professional life. But anyway, systematic and unsystematic risk. I'm going to draw on the board just a freehand version of a data set that is actually well known. On this axis, on the horizontal axis, I'm going to write the standard deviation, sigma, of various portfolios and stocks. And on the vertical axis, the returns to those securities, technically the expected return. But this is something that we see not just with stocks, but all across physical processes, what I'm going to show you here. For example, in this two-space of sigma against return, standard deviation against return, we might see something like an Amazon right about there. That would, just freehanding it. And maybe McDonald's here, Microsoft here. And you could actually do this plot, run the scatter plot. It's been done many, many times. And you can actually type into a search engine and find these kinds of things. But no matter what stock or portfolio of stocks, small portfolio of stocks, you work out the standard deviation. And we've done this for literally thousands and thousands of stocks and portfolios of stocks. They all have this odd clustering behavior that no matter what you do, what portfolio, what stock you look at, they all lie within a boundary. In physics, this is called an envelope that essentially defines the extent to which a process can be pushed under different levels of the independent variable. So, for example, you would see this in when you do exercise, there is only so far you can push yourself at any given time. More training, you can push yourself further along that x-axis. But there is always this place where you are stopped, no matter how good you get. With a car engine, no matter how finely you tune that car engine, there's only so much speed you can get out of it. No matter how much you reduce the weight of a car, no matter how much you fine-tune and make efficient the engine, there's only so far you can push the miles per gallon on a car. And then you just can't get any more out of it. No matter how large a star is, there is only so much energy that that star can pump out. The larger the star, the more that is, but we never see a star of a certain size beyond a certain boundary of energy output for it. It's all through the universe this process is. It's called an envelope of performance. Now, if I draw this envelope on this, it would look something like this, and I should have actually gotten one out of off a graph from the internet for this, but this gives you an idea. In stocks, in securities, we call this the efficient frontier of all risky investments. The efficient frontier of all risky investments. This envelope. The envelope. It's called the efficient frontier of all risky investments. You might have even heard that term, pushing the envelope. A lot of people think that means you're pushing an envelope, a mailing envelope across the table. No, it actually means that there is this place where you can get up to, bump up against it, but you can't get past it. And that is what we're seeing with securities. They all lie within this efficient frontier of all risky investments. Now, some lie very close, some lie farther away from it. But you notice that a lot, many, many stocks and portfolios of stocks, almost all of them really, are inefficient. They're inside of the frontier. They don't get even close to it. Amazon, McDonald's, Microsoft, all of those companies are actually well within the frontier. In other words, they are not efficient. One question that has been kind of interest to research types is what makes a company that is close to the frontier? We see some characteristics of them, but it's really almost kind of random in a way. But anyway, that's where your investments are when you buy a stock or a little portfolio of stocks. It is not efficient. It is inefficient. However, interestingly enough, there is an efficient portfolio that's outside of the frontier. It's not a very interesting portfolio. A portfolio of completely riskless instruments, like short-term treasury bills. If you held a short-term, a portfolio, a nice portfolio of short-term treasury bills, it would have no risk, and it would be perfectly efficient. But it's almost like, well, duh. That has no standard deviation. They just sit there. They just park, and then they just mature, and you get your $1,000 back. But they are efficient. It is that one oddball place off the efficient frontier. The next question that was asked maybe a half century ago is, okay, what would happen if we were to draw a line, a straight line that just touched the frontier of all efficient investments? In other words, a perfectly efficient portfolio that sits right on the envelope and is connected by a straight line to that risk-free portfolio, which is also efficient. This would be an efficient portfolio. Theoretically, it has to, it exists. This is an efficient portfolio clear over here at the risk-free rate, R sub F. If we could find that portfolio, then you remember that any combination, any two points define a line, then we could actually just combine the risk-free portfolio with this theoretical animal right there, and we'd have an efficient portfolio. In other words, we could actually just combine this portfolio that sits right on the efficient frontier with this risk-free portfolio, and we would have an efficient portfolio. Buy maybe half of the treasuries, half of this theoretical portfolio, and you'd have be sitting here, a completely efficient portfolio. Well, it doesn't take a whole lot to show you, and I'm not going to do it here, that place where the touches, where the tangent line touches the efficient frontier is actually the pure market portfolio. That would be all of the stocks in all of the world in a portfolio. Each one in the portfolio by weight, according to its weight in the total, its market cap, in the total market cap of the world. You can't theoretically, it's a theoretical animal. You can't do it in practice, but I'm going to tell you how you can do it in practice. And it's actually worth your time if you're going to start doing investments to know how the trick works, but that's a little later. But first of all, this line, if we could actually have the market portfolio, it would be anything that we any combination of the market portfolio and a portfolio of treasuries would be an efficient portfolio. Anywhere on this line, you could sit yourself, you could park there, and you would have a completely efficient portfolio. You try to do anything else, you ain't going to do it. You try, oh, I'm just going to buy a portfolio of stocks. Yeah, I'll buy, you know, maybe 30 stocks. Well, yeah, you're going to be somewhere up in here somewhere, but you're not going to be on the boundary. So the most efficient way, the best way would be, but unfortunately, the market portfolio you can't achieve. So how do we get from there to actual practical investment? Oh, by the way, I want let me mention something here. This line right here, this line that has two, the one point is the risk-free rate. The other point is the market portfolio, and so you've got this linear equation. We call this the capital market line. Now, I'm almost hesitant to tell you that because there's another line that's a little kind of more important to us that sounds just like this one. It's called the security market line. But for now, that one, as a matter of fact, let me do that one now. Okay. Let's do this over again. So in other words, this market portfolio is like a fulcrum. So we create an artificial measure. It's just a designed measure. We say, we use this term called beta. Beta is the systematic risk of a security or portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Now let me repeat that. Beta is the systematic risk of a security or portfolio relative to the market portfolio. One more time. Beta is the systematic risk of a security or portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Now, I repeated myself three times there. What do you suppose that means? It's kind of important, okay, for maybe an exam, I don't know, or maybe in the middle of the night, I'll text you on the phone and say, what's beta?
What the hell are you calling me at this hour, man? Just answer the question, you can go back to sleep. Okay. Before I get to that, let me show you something over here.
This right here, see this guy right here? This is Amazon. That's actually close to where, if I were to actually show you a real graph, Amazon, I think there is actually one in the textbook. Is there one in this? No, it's in another textbook I saw. That X right there, well within the efficient frontier, is actually Amazon, approximately where you would see it in one of those scatter charts of standard deviations against returns. Look at this. I'm going to show you, draw you a line here. From the Amazon portfolio backwards to what its return is. Okay, there is the sigma of AMZN right there. Again, this isn't exact, but it's actually pretty close to what you would see on a real scatter chart. And this is the return to Amazon, AMZN. Okay?
That's where it sits. We collect the data. We just put that point in there. We can do that. We do that all the time. Now, strangely, interestingly enough, though, this is where that Amazon horizontal line over to R actually intersects the security market line. And this takes a while. You've got to look at this. Draw these graphs. Just look at it over and over again. And you'll see that Amazon has this much total risk. Clear out there for this return. If you held Amazon, you would have this standard deviation and this return annualized.
But see this right here where it hits the security, the capital market line? This line right here. Is how much of that, okay, on this side, let me write it this way. The part of the line over to some AMZN that is from Amazon to the security market line is unsystematic risk. It's the part of the total standard deviation sigma that is entirely worthless. You don't get a reward for that. The part of the line from Amazon over to R that is from the security market line to the vertical axis is the systematic risk. It's massive. In most cases, when you look at individual stocks or even small portfolios, most of the risk, is the volatility, the standard deviation is useless. You don't need to have it because you could just get a portfolio on the security market line, which would have the same return as Amazon for about half of the risk of Amazon. That's true of all of these portfolios. If you draw these lines where they hit the security market line, that's an efficient portfolio you could design with treasuries and the market portfolio. The fact that you are going to invest, for example, in McDonald's, which is up here, means that all of that risk is unsystematic risk, and it's only this part of the risk that is systematic. They're all over the place. It's hard to tell. Like I said, we kind of are curious what... small companies tend to have a lot of unsystematic risk simply because they've got a lot of noise from the independent risk, the individual risk that is going on within the company. Companies that are more mature, they tend to behave more like their companies and their industry. They tend to have more stable project flows and all that. They tend to have smaller independent risks. You notice that McDonald's actually doesn't have the large unsystematic risk. Most of its risk is systematic. But in any case, you invest in individual stocks or small portfolios, you're taking a lot of risk you don't have to take, and no market is going to reward an investor who does that.
When you're up against massive, I mean, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in fund managers who are forming efficient portfolios along the security market line, you ain't going to have a chance of getting rewarded for unsystematic risk. It's just you're taking it. Good for you. It's not going to get you any reward. Well, I made a whole lot of money off this stock. Good for you. And the 10,000 investors who got their clocks clean playing that game aren't going to brag about what happened to them. You just won the lottery. Try it again a few times. Spend all that money that you got winning the lottery, and you'll lose. Okay. Now, we design beta, this metric of risk, so that all it will measure for a security or a portfolio is the part of the standard deviation that is from the security market line, from the capital market line over to the y-axis, the returns axis. We design it so that, in other words, a market portfolio, a perfect market portfolio, is all systematic risk. You see that? It's all systematic risk. It's pure. It's perfect. And so we give the beta of the market portfolio, betas of MKT, the value exactly 1. It's just a definition. We say that is the fulcrum. That's the pure point. And by definition, also, the beta of the risk-free rate of the risk-free treasuries, or whatever you want to proxy it with, is going to be exactly 0 because it has no systematic risk. See it? It's right there, right on the capital market line. And so it's going to have no standard deviation. It's going to be a purely 0 portfolio as far as beta is concerned. Therefore, now, I don't know if I want to do this. You remember from your algebra the equation for a linear equation from 2 points on the line. So in other words, there is a linear equation, a line, that has 1 point, which is the expected return to the market portfolio, comma, 1.0. Return, comma, beta. I'm just gathering some points. I know that there is a point on this beta line, for lack of a better term, that would be exactly 1, comma, the expected return to the market portfolio. Now, sometimes you'll just hear me say, the return to the market portfolio. It's really an expectation. What's going to happen? And we also know that there is the return to the risk-free, which would have the point R sub F, comma, 0.0. Again, these are points in R comma beta space, which is not sigma, because sigma had the noise in it. What we're now looking for is the equation that would plot the betas of portfolios and securities against their expected returns. This is what we're after here. So in other words, we're looking for the equation for a line that has R sub F, comma, 0, and it also has, this is the beta line, so that's 0, let's say that's 1.0 right there, and it would also have the point 1.0, comma, expected return to the market portfolio. Right there. We would know those 2 points on this beta line. And again, I'm going to give it a better name here in a minute. But anyway, if I were to connect those 2 lines,
we have the very special relationship line between betas and returns we should expect from stocks and portfolios. We call this line the security market line. Remember I said it's like the capital market line, but the capital market line plots all of the standard deviation against the expected returns. All this line does is plot the systematic risk, the beta, against the expected return to the stocks. This is the one that matters. This is the one where you are going to form portfolios that are efficient along this line. I'm almost tempted to do this equation. It's really simple. It's just finding the equation of a line from two points. But because the notation is so cumbersome, it just kind of blows you away when you see all these subscripts and all that. But it's really simple. Let me write it out without actually doing it. I used to actually do the equation of a linear equation from two points for this, and it just gave people headaches. So I'm just going to write, if I were to do that little algebra, high school algebra exercise, find the equation of a line from two points on the line, it would come out to be this for this security market line. It would come out to be that the expected return to a security or portfolio equals the risk-free rate plus the beta of that security times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Oh, shut up. I thought I killed that thing. What the hell? Anyway, there is, to some extent, almost like the culmination of the course. This thing is called the capital asset pricing model. CAPM. This is the culmination. It essentially says that the expected return, what you should expect from a security or a portfolio of securities, is going to be the risk-free rate plus the beta of that security times the difference between the expected return to the market and the risk-free rate. It's actually a very simple equation. I'll do a couple real quick here. But let me point out something. You see this thing inside the parentheses, E, the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate? That is called the expected market premium. Over the risk-free rate. Essentially, in those parentheses, it's saying how much extra should you expect to get by taking a risky position instead of a riskless position in the market. Again, let me repeat that. This thing right here, the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate, is how much extra you should expect to get by taking a risky position instead of a riskless position. And then the beta is like a factor that scales that additional premium. See, this is a premium for taking risk. Beta magnifies or demagnifies that. Okay. Let me do one in practice here. Suppose short-term T-bills are currently yielding 1.2%. And the expected return to the market is currently 12.4%.
And these are annualized, of course.
What is the expected return to a,
let's do a mutual fund,
to a mutual fund that has a beta of 0.84.
In other words, and you should remember this from previous lectures, we have invested in a relatively conservative mutual fund. This is actually the beta of one of the mutual funds in the EFIF portfolio. We have an investment portfolio that students actually manage. You take a course in finance, and you are in charge of dealing with this portfolio. And one of the mutual funds in it, matter of fact, a couple, if I saw the numbers right, are about 0.84. The worst of them is 1.1. So in other words, this is a conservative portfolio. They're managing money that's college money. But anyway, so what we would do is, and I'm going to break down some numbers here. I'm going to break this down a little bit for you so I can explain this a little more, a little better. Where the heck am I? Okay. Now, I'm somewhat careful about this usually. Okay, the expected return to the market, E of R sub MKT is 12.4%. R sub F here is 1.2%. And the beta is 0.84. Now, the first thing I'm going to do, and by all means, you don't have to do this when you're actually keying this into a calculator. I'm going to do the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate, just to make this point that I said a minute ago clearer. 12.4% minus 1.2% is 11.2%. And by the way, when you're working with the CAPM, you can use percentages. It's just the result you have to turn into a real math object, decimal and all that. But when you're working with the CAPM, it's okay. See this 11.2%? That is how much extra reward you get for taking risk on this security instead of taking no risk. That's the extra reward you get for taking risk instead of no risk. If you don't want to take a risk, you'll get 1.2%. If you want to take a risk, you'll get 12.4%. So the extra risk, the premium you get for taking risk instead of no risk, is 11.2%. That's what I mean by that expected return to the market, expected market premium over the risk-free rate. This is a good question for an exam as well. Explain the market premium over risk-free. And by the way, notice that in quick parlance, we'll say the market premium or the market premium over risk-free. We usually don't go the whole expected market premium over the risk-free rate. We oftentimes will just say the market premium or the market premium over risk-free. We don't say the whole thing, and it's okay for you to do that if you're answering an essay question. The market premium is means or something like that. Okay, anyway, okay, now let's put the CAPM together here. We would have the expected return to this mutual fund
would be 1.2%. And by the way, that's added. See that sitting there like that, right, just hanging off? That means that that's your rock bottom. You ain't going to get more. You're going to get that because no security is going to pay you less than that. That rock bottom is 1.2% plus 0.84 times the 11.2%. There. Notice with this mutual fund that it actually, the beta is deleveraging the market portfolio. In other words, the factor here is actually reducing the return. If the beta were above one, it would magnify the return. So in other words, this is a portfolio that, or this is a stock mutual fund that will get you less than the market because you're not taking as much risk of the market. And as a matter of fact, you can say beta, in this case, this mutual fund has 84% of the systematic risk of the market portfolio. Let me say that again. This beta was 0.84. That means that this mutual fund has 84% of the systematic risk of the market. In other words, it's not as risky as the market. Now, I'm going to just pull up a calculator here and just quickly throw this one on for you. And it would be the 1.2 plus 0.84 times 11.2. Is that right? Huh?
You need to change
it. No. As long as you're working inside of the cap M, you don't need to. It's only with that result you got right there. If you have to use that for something else, like valuing a present value or something like that, then you got to turn it back in. I'm glad you brought that up so I can say that one more time. See, right here, I can just say the expected return to this mutual fund is 11.61%. I'll just write it out, 11.6808%. That's what I should expect to this security to return. Huh? Oh, I'm just testing you. I just wanted to make sure. Geez, Sui, it's bad. I had a better memory when I was a drinker. Okay, now. Maybe that's why I stopped drinking. I forgot. Okay, look. Yeah, it's so in other words, just notice that the market, if you took the market portfolio, you'd get about 12.4%. This mutual fund won't get you 12.4% because it is less risky than the market. It will get you about 10.61%. That's not a bad thing or a good thing. It just simply says that this particular security is going to get you less expected return because it has lower systematic risk. And so we finally come to the actual axiom. The greater the systematic risk, the greater the expected return. Again, the greater the systematic risk, the greater the expected return. You will remember early in the course I said the greater the risk, the greater the return. Well, that was the tricycle version. And then I said the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. That was the bicycle version. And now we're on the unicycle. Or in the jet, the fighter jet, the greater the systematic risk, the greater the expected return. So don't let me trick you on an exam. If I say, what's the relationship between risk and return? The relationship, the only relationship you can actually
say is axiomatic. In other words, right, a truth almost, is that the greater the systematic risk, the greater the expected return. Just saying the greater the risk, the greater the return, that was a way to get you started thinking about the relationship. But it's not risk that matters. It's only risk that is non-diversifiable that matters in a portfolio. And it's not return that matters, it's expected return. Because all we care about is the future. We don't care what has happened in the past. So there you go. That's the Cap M. That's the whole shebang in the Cap M. The capital asset pricing model lays out this relationship. Now, I'm going to bring up... Yeah, I'm going to do something really quick here, if I can do this. And I, again, as usual, I am apologizing because I don't have my bookmarks here. But I'm pretty sure... There's what I want. Maybe. Oh, Investistupedia, Wikistupedia. Okay. Oh, here we go. This is a big list here of different betas. Now, they are showing you that beta actually, long-term average current time-varying estimate. You want the second one because it adjusts the historical data for expectation, okay? The first one is just historical data, and as I've told you, historical data can be dodgy on you. History kind of gets eaten away. So the second one is probably the one that is more interesting to you. But notice the wide range in betas that you can see here. From a company like Allstate with a 0.64 beta. In other words, this is a defensive stock in a portfolio. Its systematic risk is only about, is less than two-thirds of the market's risk. And on up to a couple of big ones, Citigroup. Look at that monster. That's 1.5 times the beta of the market. Much riskier, even in a portfolio. This is systematic risk. This isn't, imagine what its overall risk is. Remember that the systematic risk is only a piece of the overall risk. This one is what we might call a yeehaw kind of stock. Its volatility is really hard, and even when you calm it down and put it into a portfolio, it's still insane. That's not as bad. I saw one mutual fund. It just dropped my jaw. It had a beta of 3.44. In other words, 3.5 times the volatility, just the systematic risk of the market. And I thought, who would invest in that? And, of course, you got a couple of crazy fund managers. I do. Okay, whatever. But let me pull over here a little bit. I wish this one had a search engine. Coca-Cola, it's systematic. I mean, that is so quiet, so tame, as far as risk goes, systematic risk. It's really a pussycat. And, of course, that shouldn't surprise you. It's an old, mature company, extraordinarily stable production methods, distribution methods, the whole nine yards. They don't come out with weird new products that would cream. Once in a while, they come out with something new, but they're very careful about that. Some years back, Coca-Cola and Pepsi were much more experimental in their, and naturally, you saw their betas a little bit stronger, too. For example, do any of you remember Pepsi Crystal? Crystal Pepsi? I liked the stuff. I thought that was so cool. Clear Pepsi. But it didn't work. And then Coca-Cola tried some tricks with flavors. Yeah.
They brought their Pepsi down.
I know. They did. And interestingly enough, I kind of like their thinking because they thought that, well,
this is a generation that is more interested in trying new things. Your generation is. And the generation where they first brought it out, they had just come through the 80s, and they were kind of beaten a little bit by all the madness that had gone on then. And they were more conservative. So they're figuring it's a more of a, I'm glad you brought that up, because the market is different now. And that's why the historical betas are a little bit less interesting to me than the, for example, look at the historical beta on Coca-Cola versus its time varying. You see how that historical is carrying more of that risk of the old days in it? Now, Coca-Cola, some years back, they came out with different flavors of Coke. Cherry Coke, Vanilla Coke, and there was a lemon something or other. And they got their clocks cleaned with that. Now they've come back with those, but what they do is oftentimes they offer those as product variations in venue. In other words, you can get Vanilla Coke at a movie theater, for example, but they don't try to spend a lot of time putting it on the shelves at the expense of their core product. Now, McDonald's. Again, see what a pussycat McDonald's is. I mean, it's got a stable market. It doesn't try to get too crazy, too fast. I was interested in one here. Seriously? Come on. Oh, maybe it's four. Okay. I'm looking for one in particular. Oh, look at that. These are, by the way, interesting. See Qualcomm? I think I saw another one. I forgot to mention it. Qualcomm has a beta of exactly one. In other words, its systematic risk is the market. So you put that into a portfolio, a well-diversified portfolio, and it sits there like the market itself, almost like a fulcrum for the other things around it. So if you're trying to bring your beta of your portfolio down, well, if I'm trying to get it toward one, I would probably put some securities in there that are around one, like this one. Now let me go... I'm trying to find Walgreens. Walgreens Boots Alliance? What the heck is that? I was trying to find. Ah, here we go. Look at one like Target. Close to the market. Close to the market again. These are sometimes the reason we ask why. In a case like, for example, Target. Target is so attuned to the world of retail, and it tries everything it can to be your go-to place, especially for your generation, and now for your generation as it goes out of college and into its professional years, its younger professional years. And so it doesn't surprise me that I see something like that. Now, I'm going to do something here real quick. I'm going to back up here. Whoops, I didn't mean to do that. And I'm going to, by the way, tell you about... I just tapped on it. What the heck? Betas of 2.6, 2.7, 2.8, 3.1... These are stocks, if you want to form a really risky portfolio, therefore having higher expected return, there's your dinner right there. Just pull those into a weighted portfolio, a nicely weighted portfolio, and you've got something that is going to either make you a lot of money or it's going to turn you into someone who probably is going to sit on a street corner cursing the world. I'm trying to find something here. Give me a second. Oh. Here's what I want. Okay. Negative beta stocks, and I should have just done this. Now, I was kind of hoping I'd see a trading symbol. Here we go. Here. G-Y-E-N. And I'll show you this real quick here. Let me get this off here. I'm using Internet Explorer, for heaven's sakes. Bad mistake to begin with. Okay, let me go to finance, G-Y-E-N. No, I don't work. Okay, finance, G-Y-E-N. And I've talked about this before, and I'm just reemphasizing it. What? Oh, well, that was an idea. It didn't work, so let me see. Huh? Yeah, that's apparently GYN is bit in the dust. Okay, anyway, let me try it this way. I'm going to try a gold stock. Okay. Gold. There we go. Negative. A negative beta. In other words, this stock is more likely to go down when the market is up and up when the market is down. These are called, again, and I've said this before, now I'm formally introducing it, contrarian. Contrarian. C-O-N-T-R-A-R-I-A-N. Contrarian stocks. You can even buy contrarian mutual funds. Essentially, as an old friend of mine who was an old curmudgeon called it, he said, these are the old SOB stocks. Because you have to be an SOB to not believe the market will go up. These are highly bearish. You take these positions if you are sure that the market is going to go through the floor. There are some who argue that cryptocurrencies have a contrarian facet to them. In other words, cryptos would probably be considered a safe haven in a world where the physical currencies had become highly, highly disliked and suspect. Does anyone know what Bitcoin has reached as? Is Bitcoin falling or rising? Rising. Do you know where it is right now as far as current trading against the dollar? Yeah. What is it?
I think it's
7,200. Yeah. Where was it a few years ago? You know,
oh, it's never going to go anywhere. It's dying. It's like $80.
Well, not 7,000. So in other words, there must be a lot of weird people out there who are highly, highly concerned about the stability of the U.S. dollar. It's similarly, it's behaving in the same way against other major physical current fiat currencies of the world. It's even stronger as far as growth behavior is concerned than gold is. And gold, see, this is something you invest in if you believe that the market is going to hell in a handbasket. These are the contrarians. And they're, like I said, you can get mutual funds that are contrarian mutual funds. They invest in negative beta instruments. How far can beta go negative? Well, I thought, well, it shouldn't go past maybe about 0.5, negative 0.5. Well, I've seen negative 1.27, negative 1.86. They can be heavily, heavily opposite in reaction to the market. So if you're that kind of a person, they are there for you at all times. Now, let me show you the spider one more time. This is an ETF of the market, of the Standard & Poor's 500. Notice that it is a pure. It does have unsystematic risk in it. Don't get me wrong. Buying a spider and thinking, well, I have the market portfolio, you are not correct. The standard deviation is a little larger scaled. So
just keep that in mind, okay? That this is a good part of a portfolio, but it is not in and of itself the market portfolio. It does emulate the market very nicely. Let me show you a bond fund. This is an ETF. Let me show you a bond fund. AGG. This one, see how closely it performs to the market? And notice, interestingly enough, that with a beta of this, its yield is this. That's an interesting, that's not a spectacular yield, but it is a bond fund. It is a safe haven. Putting together a SPDR and AG and AGG and a couple of other very nicely diversified portfolios that also have betas right around one, you can pretty much have the market portfolio. That's an important point. One of the trading strategies that I'll teach you in the next lecture is that we can't do the market portfolio. We can't do it. It's a theoretical thing. It's just impossible. You know, every stock in the world and its weight in your portfolio is the same as the weight of its market cap in the world portfolio, of the market cap of the world portfolio. You can't do it. But what you can do is maybe four very well-diversified portfolios, a SPDR, an AG, and a couple others around one, and bingo, you've got something that is awfully, awfully close to the true market portfolio. Very little systematic, unsystematic risk in it. You've squeezed out almost all of it because a lot of it was squeezed out in the fund itself. And so, yeah, even though the market portfolio is in itself, in and of itself, theoretical, you can create something that is awfully darn close to it. Now, one more thing that I do want to bring up here. I'm going to show you something here that's way out, not what you would get in the textbook, but it's something really important. And when you're looking at mutual funds or other kinds of investment vehicles, the different products out here, there's a number that you'll see. And you even saw that one website I passed by quickly, Seeking Alpha. That's actually a play on words. Look, here is the capital market line. Here's the expected return to the market portfolio. There's the risk-free rate down there at a lower value. Okay, let's say the beta is 1.0 here. Okay, so we can draw the security market line like that. That's the CAPM line right there, okay? Now, this is a number you should always check if you're buying a mutual fund or something like that. Efficient portfolios will lie on this, right smack on it, okay? Portfolios can be below it. It's really unusual to see something that actually beats the envelope, as it were. This is an envelope, actually. But they do happen. But you got to be careful about the measure. So, for example, suppose that there is a portfolio that has a beta of, let's say, 1.4. Well, its expected return, this is portfolio A. The expected return, according to CAPM, of this should be that much for a beta of 1.4. Should be about that. Suppose that beta, the return that you get from it, is actually a little bit less. Let's say it's down here. It's not quite what CAPM says. It's underperforming a little bit. We call that difference right there, that difference in what you think you should get versus what actually happens, we call that alpha. Or more technically, Jensen's alpha. And you'll see it. It is reported for mutual funds. What's the Jensen's alpha? And what that does is it tells you how close that fund got to dead on to the market. Now, This one you see, the alpha is a little bit negative. If you are in a portfolio, you build your own portfolio of mutual funds, you see negative alphas, you kick those out and buy into positive alphas. That's one trading strategy, is to always be clearing out negative alphas. Those are the fund managers who are underperforming the market. Now, once in a while, though, you'll see, let's say we've got some mutual fund that's got a really strong risk, 1.7. It should perform right here. This is portfolio B. It should perform, get a return right here. But what we find is that it actually gets a return above the envelope. That would be a positive Jensen's alpha on that one. That's what you're looking for all the time, trying to find positive Jensen's alphas. They're not going to be spectacular. They're not going to be huge. that one portfolio I saw that was had mutual funds in it, I saw one Jensen's alpha that was negative 3.17%. In other words, it was underperforming for its risk level. It was underperforming by 3.17. Oh, you get rid of that right away. I mean, a slightly negative Jensen's alpha, that's not something to worry about. But when you see Jensen's alphas that are really negative, get away from them. When you see Jensen's alphas that are positive, go towards them. But always remember that if it's too positive, I would be suspicious that there's something wrong. There's something wrong in the calculation. Positive Jensen's alphas happen. Negative Jensen's alphas happen. But it's something that, if you took more finance, I'd talk about this and a few other metrics more significantly. But if I'm going to teach you enough to make you dangerous and make you think you can do investment, I would be remiss not to tell you that when you're looking, look at your beta. If you're investing in mutual funds or ETFs, look at your beta and then look at your alpha, because both of them are going to tell you a lot about what's going to happen when you invest in those. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.